Good morning. I'm Jeff Burton. I'm the chair of this session. We're in session 311, the changing general conference rhetoric of Latter-day Saint prophets. We have the honor of hearing today from Richard N. Armstrong. He's an associate professor and also director of the public speaking programs at Wichita State University. He came out of Southern Utah University and went to Brigham Young for a master's degree and got his PhD at Bowling Green State University. He's published a number of articles in the various scholarly journals and presented many papers at academic conferences, and he's published two academic books. He tells me his most recent manuscript that he's working on now is called Mormon Oratory, the General Conference Rhetoric of the Latter-day Saint Prophets, which reviews the General Conference speaking of all the presidents of the LDS Church. Sounds like a big project. We're looking forward to that book when it comes out. He also says his current project is a review of the addresses delivered by women in General Conference. That should be fairly quick. A little smaller. Anyway, we're really happy to have him. I would remind you, please, to turn your cell phones to the vibrate position. When we get finished, we'll have time for questions and comments, and we'll have you come to the front. We'll talk about that when we get to that point. So, Richard?
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Very happy to see you, especially on this rainy Saturday morning. So 8:45 a.m. That's fantastic. We've already met one former acquaintance, Jerry Argesinger, over here from the National Technical Institute for the Deaf back in Rochester, New York. We co-authored a scholarly article for a communication journal clear back in the late 70s, early 80s, something like that. Jerry was a director of the Hill Cumorah pageant, and I was at the State University of New York at Brockport, and we decided to put our different fields of expertise together and got something published, and haven't seen him since. But I know he looked familiar when he came up, but he's a slimmer version of the old Jerry, at least I remember. So I'm thinking that about him, and what's he thinking about me? No, I didn't have hair then either, so. Anyway, when I was working on my dissertation back in the mid-70s at Bowling Green in Ohio, which was on the public speaking of David O. McKay, the general conference speaking, I started getting a little bit of an idea about a much bigger work that someday would be nice to do, you know what I mean, someday. And over the years, I've worked on it, almost got it done, a book on the general conference speaking of the presidents of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And now I'm looking for a publisher. One university press had it for 2.5 years and set me back a little bit, but they'll remain nameless. But I'll be more assertive next time, I guess. But you know, I never had a chance to collect baseball cards when I was a kid, like a lot of young boys do. And I envied that a bit in my three boys who all did that. And I don't know if it was a money situation or what when I was a kid, but I just didn't do it. So I knew I had to be a collector of some sort, though, right, to make my mark in life, as it were. And I don't think you can imagine how happy I was last week when this item I'm going to show you right now, in just a second, arrived in the mail, my mailbox at Wichita State. It was preceded a week or so earlier by one of those little postcards from Benchmark. And, you know, I got on the list for some things I was looking for years ago. I think that was from 2005. I was shocked that they still had me on the list for those things. So when this arrived, April 1929, conference report. This is what I've collected over the years. For years, when my wife and I and our kids would take vacations, it would always be in Utah, because that's where the family was, even though we're living in Kansas, New York and Kansas. And I would always get my department to pay part of the vacation by saying it was going to be a research trip, and it always was, because I'd either come up to the church archives or I'd go to whatever rare bookstore I could find that dealt in old LDS stuff. By the way, is it Sam Weller's yesterday? They don't have the three volumes I still need, darn it. That stuff from the 40s and a couple from the 30s, but not the ones I'm looking for. I guess that's why I'm still looking for them, right? Because they're extremely rare. But I have a shelf that's full of almost an entire set now of conference reports, and these are my primary resource materials. I know there's other places you can get information, but for some reason I've decided that conference reports makes the most sense. Now, I have learned over the years that they're not perfect. I don't think anything is. Occasionally there's something there that's been changed just a little bit, or occasionally there's something missing that was given for various reasons. But overall, I'm confident that conference reports are pretty credible as far as recording the rhetoric, as I call it. That just means persuasion. You know, it doesn't mean bombast or anything like that in our field of the presidents of the church. So for years, off and on, I've been writing chapter by chapter of the 16 presidents. I do a little biography in the front of the chapter. My first chapter is an overview of general conference in the LDS history over the years, and hit some highlights and give some context for what's to follow and why I'm using conference reports. And then the next 16 chapters, I'm still working on the Thomas S. Monson one. By the way, I was at Deseret Book yesterday, the one downtown here, and I asked a couple of people that worked there if there was any street talk on a biography of President Monson, and because I haven't heard anything. I've been looking for a while. And one of the gentlemen that worked there said there is one underway. He's not quite sure who's doing it. He doesn't think it's Sherry Dew. She's too busy now, I guess, or something. And that what he heard, why there's been a little delay in the biography, is that President Monson did not want to have one come out so soon after President Hinckley passed away. But I'm kind of feeling incomplete in that chapter without a biography, you know, to refer to. I've got all the other stuff that President Monson has published and things that mention him and Ensign articles and, you know, anything I can get my hands on, but it'd be nice to get a biography. So I'm going to keep looking. I'm going to guess the Deseret Book is going to publish it, so that shouldn't be hard to keep track of, right? But that's where I am right now. So over the years, I've presented, we in higher education, as many of you probably realize, are under some pressure to publish or perish. And even though presenting at conferences is not publishing, it's still a curriculum vitae notch, so to speak. And so I've been out here several times to report the results of chapters on the presidents. I presented at the National Communication Association and other various conferences as well, so that I get conference presentation credit and hopefully a book eventually. I've also published one of the chapters in Dialogue some years ago, 97 or something like that. I can't remember which. That was just on the general conference history. I actually... By the way, just so you know, I've been a practicing Latter-day Saint since 1962, when I joined at age 17. I'm currently have a YSA branch back in Wichita, Kansas, and my wife is the Stake Relief Society president, so we're very busy and devout. But, you know, nothing's perfect, and I have discovered some things over the years that have reinforced to me that, in this case, men are men. And no prophet, LDS prophet, has ever claimed infallibility or perfection for himself either. And I find that refreshing, even though some critics of the church somehow find a little imperfection and decide to jump, you know, and we're all wrong because of that one little imperfection, I guess. So I that doesn't bother me at all. So what I've come to you today with is a draft chapter that's the summary and conclusions chapter of this manuscript. And I'd like to share a couple of findings from that, if you wouldn't mind. And then, of course, have some questions afterwards. I went into this with a couple of assumptions. I'm not going to bore you to death, by the way, with a couple of the theories that I've employed here. One's called the narrative paradigm by Walter Fisher. And the other one is identification, persuasion through identification by Kenneth Burke, a literary and rhetorical critic. Walter Fisher's a communication professor, formerly at University of Southern California, been retired for quite a few years now. Kenneth Burke is no longer with us. I saw him at a convention one in Washington, D.C., and he was thoroughly drunk. Quite entertaining, but as a young graduate student, you know, that was kind of disappointing. But anyway, I went into this, as I say, with some preconceived notions. You always have to have some theses, so to speak, right, to start a study. And my thesis was, the main one, was that Joseph Smith's ideas, which I was going to say for the time, but obviously nothing much has changed, were quite amazing to many people, if you will, even blasphemous, certainly food for thought, different. And I was theorizing that the presidents of the church who followed Joseph Smith would pay homage to him, respect him and his work, by often referring to his doctrinal tableau, if you will. And his smorgasbord, that's not a good term, but his variety of earth-shattering, earth-shaking doctrines, if you will. Some of them, for example, could be the concept of a plurality of gods, eternal progression, including the possibility of exaltation of godhood for everyone, or godhood for everyone, a non-triune godhead, rejection of original sin, various saving ordinances for the dead in temples, eternal marriage, the three degrees of glory or three heavens, and plural marriage, for example. And there were others. And I wanted to follow through the presidential speaking over the years and see if any of these doctrines came through. And I'll tell you the results of that study a little bit later in my presentation. I'm trying to paraphrase this, doing it extemporaneously, because if you're like me, it gets kind of old, have it being read to word for word. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I also, under the so-called narrative paradigm, the idea being that topics, subjects stressed by leaders become unifying attempts, if you will, among those who listen to them, in other words, church members in this case, and the president of the church. And some of them, for example, first of all, let me tell you this, that some of the topics I just mentioned were indeed addressed by several presidents that followed President Smith. For example, Brigham Young often paid tribute to Joseph Smith in his visionary thinking. He's very faithful. John Taylor, the third president, often railed against the federal government over its attempts to compel the LDS Church to abandon polygamy. Found something pretty interesting, I thought, about John Taylor. You know, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think people that would visit the LDS sacrament meeting, many from some backgrounds would find our meeting, shall I say, staid, a little conservative, a little reserved, if you will. But you know what? John Taylor, in general conference, actually employed what I'd call a call-and-response method of sermonizing. He would say at the end of something, amen, and the congregation would yell back, amen. He sometimes would ask for a show of hands, you know, at the end of a proposition or something. And I found that interesting because I don't think we see that in general conference, do we, or sacrament? I'd feel kind of weird trying to do that myself, I'll tell you. We are kind of a reserved people in that regard. But anyway, President Taylor was so annoyed with the federal government and his defense of polygamy that he referred to what he called an official persecution as federal Christianity. Federal Christianity. I like that term. I like it. Very good. I'm sure you're all familiar with Lorenzo Snow, the fifth president, and his often mentioned persecutions from anti-Mormons. I shared that with John Taylor as well. Heber J. Grant, the seventh president, continued to speak on the concept of defending ourselves against persecution. And he also highlighted temple work And I don't know if you realize this or not, but it was Heber J. Grant that elevated the Word of Wisdom to commandment status in about 1924. Other than that, it was a strong suggestion, and finally made it a temple recommend type question. Other doctrines didn't receive as much attention. For example, seldom did a conference hear from the president on the potential of godhood for all or the logically following multiplicity of God's doctrine. That kind of started falling away. Now, I've seen this in other places, and so I wanted to investigate it for myself, especially since I had written a dissertation on the public speaking of David O. McKay, who happened to be the president of the church when I joined at age 17. But David O. McKay was ordained ninth president in 1951, and along with others, I noted that his general conference rhetoric changed even more, perhaps, than some of his predecessors, away from some of Joseph Smith's more interesting doctrines, shall we say. And he started emphasizing more what I'd call Christocentric, more mainstream. And I'm not saying this is a virtue necessarily, but a more mainstream Christianity type of vernacular was employed by President McKay. And I don't know if it was conscious or just serendipitous, if you will, but the LDS Church grew increasingly during President McKay's 19 years at the helm. And some researchers have theorized that this was because the LDS Church seemed more Christian-centered as a result of David O. McKay's rhetoric. And I think I have to agree with that, especially the amount of it. I've got a point a little bit later about the main emphasis of all of the LDS presidents. Okay, so here we come to the point there. Even though I saw the change in David O. McKay's rhetoric, I came up with something I consider kind of significant for my work, and I've come to the conclusion that I'm going to have to differ with some of the commentators out there, the researchers, as to President McKay's emphasis, and was he a major harbinger of change. I found that every single one of the LDS presidents regularly and strongly emphasized the divinity, messiahship, of Jesus Christ as our central doctrine. And whether it was Joseph Smith or Brigham Young or Joseph Fielding Smith or David O. McKay or Gordon B. Hinckley, Thomas S. Monson, there's no doubting, if you read it, you know, you can't say Latter-day Saints aren't Christians, they don't believe in Jesus Christ as the Savior of the world, because we're telling you that's what we believe through our paramount leaders over and over and over again. Now, for those of you who follow the LDS Church over the years and or are members, this is not news. But to the people outside of the LDS Church who may have been reading work from people that aren't part of our PR team, shall we say, they might have a different view, you know. So I just want you to know that there's nothing to be afraid of in here when you read the works of the presidents of the LDS Church and General Conference and what they think about Jesus Christ. It's very, very clear. Now, I think perhaps that some of these other ideas may have come about because some of the other researchers who've done something like this, they have analyzed the addresses of all the general authorities. Mine is restricted to only the presidents. And I'm not saying that some of the other general authorities haven't been a little more out there at times than what the president might have been about some of the doctrine. I'll have to do a research study that way and see. The only major one I know about that along those lines was published by the University of Utah in, I think it was 1979, Shepherd and Shepherd. Do I have it here in this article? Yeah. A Kingdom Transformed, Themes in the Development of Mormonism. 1984, it actually came out. And they're sociologists, I think they're LDS, and they did a sociological statistical review of all of the speaking of the LDS general authorities over the years as per topic. And that's a very interesting work if you can get that. Again, mine is only with the presidents. Skipping ahead here. I don't want to go too much beyond a half an hour. Last some time for questions. Now, some would argue, and I guess I could too if I wanted to, that maybe advances in rhetorical arrangement, preciseness from some presidents, maybe eloquence somewhere along the line, they were gradually raised to a higher level. But I argue in my study that what accounts for the effectiveness of the Latter-day Saint prophets getting their message out to the members of the church, and perhaps even some beyond the church, was what I call ascribed ethos. By the very nature of its office, that is a powerful bully pulpit, if you will. And devout Latter-day Saints pretty much say, okay, if the prophet says it, must be the real McCoy. And they will follow him. I mean, you remember what President Hinckley a few years ago in the Book of Mormon, I think he announced that in July and asked people to read it by the end of the year, I think, and kind of took on a life of its own. You know, the church news had a weekly timetable where you should be at that point if you're going to finish by the end of the year, and Ensign articles, and you could see it all over the culture, renewed emphasis in the Book of Mormon, kind of following up on Ezra Taft Benson's emphasis during his presidency. I did find something kind of interesting, taken from my dissertation, at least to me, interesting. I had the opportunity to interview Claire Middlemiss back in the 70s when I was working on the dissertation. She was President McKay's longtime secretary, about 35 years, I think. And she was retired and elderly, and I just called her up on the phone one day and explained who I was, what I was working on, and would she consent to me coming up and talking to her about President McKay and his public speaking. And she graciously agreed, and she allowed me to tape it, and I used some of it in my dissertation. But she revealed that at one point, President McKay started asking her to become a clipping service, if you will, for him, about crime statistics, you know, moral problems in the country, good things, bad things. If she saw something in a newspaper or a magazine that maybe he could use in a general conference address or some other address that would be appropriate, she would cut it out for him and present it to him. I guess she kept it in a scrapbook or something, let him know what was available. And I'm not sure very many others before that, before President McKay, did that. Perhaps they did, but I didn't come across it. And I'm pretty sure that every president since then has had something like that going on. And of course, with the internet these days, almost everything's easily retrievable. And as far as the rhetoric, the oratory being increased, being raised to a higher level, you know, we have teleprompters now. For clear into George Albert Smith's presidency, died in 51, just for President McKay. Extemporaneous speaking, in other words, not memorized, not read word for word, was the way to go. And even George Albert Smith, when he actually heard Matthew Calley, remember him, had all those amazing healing stories and everything in the South Pacific. For some reason, Matthew Calley of the 12 decided to read a talk during conference, and President Smith, one account says, called him aside afterwards and basically commanded him not to do that anymore. He said, you need to rely on the Spirit. Don't write it down, you know, that sort of thing. But after that, you know, and now we have the teleprompters and we have video clips that can be added and we have PowerPoints and all this that we can see on the screen. And maybe for some people, maybe younger people, I don't know, especially, that makes it more interesting to many. And maybe some would even call that eloquence, I don't know. So as I alluded to earlier at the beginning today, contemporary LDS presidential rhetoric has virtually none of the flamboyance seen in the pathos, fiery pathos, or otherwise emotion-evoking rhetoric of, for example, fundamentalist conservative preachers, some televangelists that I've also done some work on, by the way, and because that fascinates me. I was flipping across the channels once some years ago, and I saw this guy who happened to be an American Baptist, not Southern Baptist, American Baptist, have a real interesting format. He had somebody representing a group that he obviously didn't agree with, and he had himself and usually somebody that worked with him, an author, who would attack that person. They even had an LDS guy on there one time who I actually met once. He was a, I think they were called regional reps back then when I knew him, but he basically ambushed them. And I don't know why anybody would go on a show like that, knowing that you were going to be dished a lot of garbage. And but that fascinated me, so I had to do some research on that and wrote an article for a journal on that as well. I enjoy religious rhetoric, whether it's LDS or not, much of it. Now I want to come to somebody that I'm sure most people in the Salt Lake Valley have heard of, Robert Kirby. Ring a bell? Okay. I believe he is LDS, is that true? Okay. But the Tribune, I guess, likes him because he can be, shall we say, irreverent at times, you know, but in an interesting, funny way, right? Okay. But I even came across a clipping of his talking about what he calls conference speak, C-O-N-F-U-R-N-Z, conference speak, and permit me to read this short excerpt. That to him, quote, refers to the way general authorities give their talks, that measured, methodical, uniform, and even contrived manner they have of speaking publicly. For me, conference speak is every bit as formulaic, remember this is Robert Kirby, imitative and distracting as a bellowed harangue from a televangelist. What's being said is obscured by how it's being said. There was a time when Mormon leaders put themselves into their talks. In the old conference days, church members were threatened by Brigham Young, insulted by J. Golden Kimball, and mystified by B.H. Roberts. Gradually, church leaders became correlated in dress and speech. I'm guessing that the move was to make the message more important than the individual. For individuals like me, it just made the message harder to hear. Close quote. There may be some truth there for some. I don't know. Then he goes on and says, watching a conference doesn't work for me. Get it later, you know, and read it word for word. We're not distracted by the person speaking. And then he gets a lot out of it, he says. But I'm throwing that in, I think. I think that's interesting. Skipping ahead here. I want to reemphasize what I said earlier, that in the final analysis, the effectiveness of the LDS prophets as rhetors has largely depended not on their rhetorical strategies, topic selection, or individual eloquence, but I would argue on the office that they hold. It doesn't mean they're not good speakers, doesn't mean they aren't effective and wouldn't be in other forums and contexts, but for this context, LDS Church context especially, I think it depends on the office more than anything else. And I don't think too many other religious groups would benefit from that situation. Maybe Roman Catholicism would be one with the Pope, that sort of thing. Okay. A couple other little pieces of information here. Following Brigham Young, the average age at which a new prophet took office has been 78, and the average length of service as an apostle before becoming president has been 41 years. Talk about on-the-job training, right? That's amazing, getting them ready for the office. So by that time, when they were ordained president, they were well-seasoned, well-prepared, had developed their leadership abilities, and even though they didn't benefit from formal traditionary seminary in theology or homiletics, didn't seem to matter. I want to share a little glimpse into the pressure of being the president of the LDS Church as far as public speaking is concerned. We can imagine what the pressure is on them, I'm sure. But I have something here I took from, I think his name is Robert. No, Edward. Edward Kimball's book, Lengthen Your Stride, The Presidency of Spencer W. Kimball. Ezra Book, who wrote this about his father, President Spencer W. Kimball. He was talking to him right after he assumed the presidency. Quote, it quickly became apparent that the demand for the president as a public speaker was insatiable. General and area conferences were just the tip of the iceberg. In nearly every meeting he attended, he was expected to speak, President Kimball. In an October 8, 1974 letter, he noted that he had spoken in Arizona the previous week, in Provo the day before, and he had about 20 more speaking engagements before the end of the year. As a result, he was often frantically wrestling and studying, trying to get something appropriate. He knew that each occasion was, for most of his listeners, an unusual occasion. They expected a great deal from him, and he tried to respond, close quote. Can you imagine that kind of pressure? If I have to speak in sacrament meeting, you know, once or twice a year, that's a lot of pressure on me, you know. But I don't know how they do it. Getting close to the end, it's common to hear Latter-day Saints say that each prophet comes along just when their special emphasis or manner is needed. As an example, 11th President Harold B. Lee observed, quote, "As I have known of the lives of those who have preceded me, I have been made aware that each seemed to have had this special mission for his day and time," close quote. I think that's a pretty astute observation, and I would agree. For example, Brigham Young, after Joseph Smith, the founding prophet, Brigham Young was the steadying influence, the organizer, the energizer, the colonizer, the rock-solid leader by force of personality when this is so greatly needed after the prophet's murder. And by the way, I don't know if you're like me or not, but you may have been a little afraid over the years to really get into the Journal of Discourses because you've heard that Brigham Young was off the planet sometimes, you know, so to speak, and some of his ideas. You know what? There's not much of that. There really isn't. There was a study by a couple of BYU professors a few years ago. I think Jay Welch is one of them, you know, the BYU studies editor, law professor, and I don't know if I got him quoted here. No, I don't have it in this bibliography. But he and his co-author found, after doing a pretty exhaustive study of the Journal of Discourses, that most of Brigham Young's talks had to do with practical issues, like the type of how are you supposed to make your bonnet, you know, if you were a sister, and that kind of stuff, and reaming people out, you know, people need a little kick in the rear to get going, and this sort of thing, and almost all of it extemporaneous. He wrote a lot, but his speaking was extemporaneous. He didn't write that down word for word by any means. So there's a lot of stuff out there that people might think is true that I don't think actually is. John Taylor doggedly defended the church against government anti-polygamy efforts, rallied the people to stay the course until every means of legal remedy could be exhausted, and they were. 5-4 Supreme Court vote to uphold those laws, basically designed to get the Mormons to give up polygamy. Wilford Woodruff had the foresight and courage to issue the manifesto, as you know, spelling the end, the official end of plural marriage, which led at least to the end of federal prosecutions and then statehood for Utah in 96, I think it was. Lorenzo Snow successfully motivated more Latter-day Saints to practice the principle of paying tithing, thus starting the LDS Church on the path to financial stability. Joseph F. Smith clarified work for the dead, performing the temples, and continued to emphasize the word of wisdom and tithing as well as forgiveness. Heber J. Grant elevated the word of wisdom, as I said earlier, to commandment status. Interestingly, he also advocated prohibition and the League of Nations from the General Conference pulpit. I found that was interesting. George Albert Smith's many friendships with non-Latter-day Saints, his support of scouting, and love for all built many bridges of understanding between the LDS Church and the greater society. And then the charismatic, and some would say, can I use this word, more liberal, David O. McKay represented an affable new face of Mormonism, won a lot of friends for the church, and then he did focus more on mutually shared historic Christian values, and probably more important than that, he inspired the membership to be more missionary-minded. You remember there, remember a missionary. Quote, Joseph Fielding Smith, he's the scriptural scholar and doctrinal purist, emphasized core doctrine in unadorned fashion. He built faith and preached on the importance of magnifying the priesthood. Harold B. Lee acknowledged the distinctive nature of the LDS Church, apart from other Christian denominations, lamented attacks on the church, and deteriorating social conditions, societal conditions, and began the process of instituting better correlation methods and practices among the many areas of church government, curriculum, policy, and practice. We all know about the 1978 revelation to President Kimball, enabling all worthy male members, 12 and older, to hold the priesthood. I know there are some sisters that wish somebody would have the revelation enabling the sisters to hold the priesthood. And you know, if that happened, that's not a problem for me, you know, because if it came to the prophet, I would believe it. It's not a problem, no. I don't want it to sound patronizing, but, you know, I don't do anything without talking to my wife, you know, and getting her input on things in the church. It's my role as a branch president and other things I've done. And I've told my boys for many years, you know, they're all three of them are married now, and I said, you know, just do what she wants you to do, and things will be fine. It's worked that out that way for me. Okay. I'm not trying to be patronizing. I really believe that. So anyway, concluding, if the effectiveness of the Mormon prophets, rhetorically, can't be reasonably explained by their oratorical abilities, which, although varied, were typically not extraordinary in the traditional sense, what then is the explanation? With all due respect to Aristotle and his pyramid of ethos, logos, and pathos model of persuasion, I submit that Mormon prophets are persuasive mainly as a result of their ascribed ethos by virtue of their position. So strong is their appeal to fellow communicants that when the prophet speaks, Latter-day Saints respond. Now, I don't know if you've thought about this before. You probably have. I don't know. But I find this interesting still. Maybe the argument I'm just making can be seem a little more plausible when it's understood, and you reflect upon it, that there's virtually no opportunity for a cult of personality or celebrity worship to develop in the LDS Church. I'm not saying some members don't have their favorites among the general authorities, especially at the local level, though. For example, the church members attend a specific ward or branch, as you know, based on geography, and there's no opportunity to follow somebody they think is a fantastic, motivating speaker, bishop, or branch president, right? Yes, you can write a letter and you know, all of this and try to get to go to another ward, and occasionally that happens, but I don't think for this reason. There are no mega churches in the LDS Church, and local services are not broadcast. Beyond this, bishops are lay leaders who are called by their stake president after approval from the First Presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve to preside, and they usually don't serve much longer than 5 or 6 years or so. Unlike the early years of the church, they do not deliver weekly sermons like their pastoral counterparts in other denominations, and unless retired, they hold a full-time job, usually unrelated to their ecclesiastical calling. And, you know, the members take part in sacrament meeting by giving talks they're asked to give. So there's virtually no opportunity to develop a following based on personality and charismatic oratorical appeal. In addition, there is no tradition, I would argue, or concept of attending an LDS worship service to be entertained, even musically. Although that does happen occasionally, which is nice. But get this, although brass bands were common in General Conference in the 19th century, there now are no bands, no praise bands. And for example, unless maybe it's creeping in some developing parts of the world, I don't know, no drums, no guitars, no trumpets or saxophones. Usually music, simple congregational singing of hymns accompanied by an organ. There may be a choir number and occasionally perhaps a soloist accompanied by a piano or maybe a flautist. But the numbers performed are almost always reverentially subdued. There's never an attempt to musically arouse the congregation to emotional heights that I can tell, which could be potentially exploited by a religious leader with questionable motives. And in fact, many non-LDS observers, as I said earlier, would most likely characterize our services as staid. And beyond that, we don't hold elections in the church. So, I mean, in a way, that was done in the 12 at the very beginning after Joseph Smith's martyrdom, but no longer. And so who am I trying to impress, you know? What votes can I get by my oratory and that sort of thing? So there's no motivation for that kind of aspiration to secure high office because of your speaking ability. Education Week aside, and what's that thing that the kids go to, especially for youth, you know, and that kind of stuff. And I'm not going to name names, but, you know, we know who they are. But they're probably not going to be called to be general authorities because they hold youth spellbound and sell a few books. I don't know. So let me just finish up. By saying this, I have found this study, reading all of the General Conference addresses that I could find in published places like, you know, conference reports. And of course, I had to look at the History of the Church and Journal of Discourses and collection by Stye, what's his name? Brian Stye? Collections of Discourses, kind of a fill-in-the-gap thing. And Eric Bateman's work, you know, The Prophets Have Spoken, that sort of thing. I haven't been turned off by anything, really, that the prophets have said. Haven't had my faith, haven't started to question my faith or anything like that. I have found that they seem to have been good people with the good, ultimate good in mind for the people that they were preaching to, most generally the Latter-day Saints. And very few of them were what would be called William Jennings Bryant quality speakers, even Barack Obama type speakers. They were successful, I believe, and I argue, because of their position in the church. No scandal, you know, done fine. So thank you very much. I'll be glad to take some questions.
We have about 15 minutes for questions. You will need to come to the microphone, and it would be a good idea to get to the microphone before you begin to speak. And also, maybe if you'll give your first name so Richard will know who he's talking to. So,
my name's Steve. I've heard it said that Catholics claim infallibility of the Pope, but act as though he's not. Mormons don't claim infallibility, but act as though he is. You've only briefly mentioned Robert Kirby's sort of standardized approach, his observation that there is a sort of standardized approach to Mormon general authority speaking. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was in 1984 that Elder Ronald Pullman gave a general conference talk that was a little bit disappointing to the brethren, and from what I understand, they had him go back and record that differently. The message was off track.
Right.
And then that re-recording, I understand, also included certain cough tracks. Now, I wonder why the message was so disconcerting to the brethren that they went to that effort to get the correct reporting on that.
That's interesting. Yeah, that did happen. And he was not excommunicated for it or even released from, I don't know, 70 or assistant at the time, whatever he was. And I really don't think something like that would happen today. I think that with FAIR and these other organizations and everything, and I believe a more open approach to things in the church, people are becoming more confident, even at the general level, in what Latter-day Saints stand for, and are able to say somebody had a misunderstanding or they made a mistake. Yeah, that's in there. We didn't see a need to correct it. I don't know. Anybody else got an insight on that?
May I change the subject slightly?
Oh, okay.
Did you find any evidence that the subject matter for conference talks is in some way suggested or controlled by somebody?
There's probably no way to really know that for sure. I can only take them upon what has been said that I've read from different people, especially the presidents who've said that people are not told what to speak on. But it is amazing, they say, that oftentimes a theme does seem to emerge, even though people did not get told what to speak on or maybe didn't even know what others were working on. That's all I know.
My experience is not primarily focused on prophets speaking in conference, but I have rather vivid memories during the administration of Heber J. Grant of talks that were given in local conferences. And it seems to me that it is interesting as to what is not talked about as well as what was talked about. That is, there was a lot of talk in my day as a young man of the gathering of Israel, of the immediacy of Christ's second coming, and those speeches devoted to that, those subjects are extremely rare today. Does your study indeed deal in any way with what isn't said as a clue to what the brethren think is important now as opposed to some other period?
Well, those topics you mentioned were emphasized in the early days of the church much more, and very seldom, if at all, anymore. I don't know if people have been given a prohibition or not. I just don't know. I think the idea, if I had to guess a little bit, would be conference has developed, you know, in the old days, you know, it was a huge business meeting. There were actually church court type things that were taken care of in conference and all that sort of thing. But now it's instructional, it's edifying, it's motivational, all in a non-threatening, non-controversial way. And I don't, you know, the church, of course, has contracted over the years with different public relations companies. Maybe there's been some advice there that has steered that a little bit. I don't know. That'd be an interesting study to find out.
One more thing, and I'm sorry to hog the microphone. A few years ago, vocal coaches were employed by the Tabernacle Choir to teach them, to give them drills in things like diction and style and
Great.
So on. Is there any evidence that there is some direction offered to those who want technique in public speaking?
Good question. See, the problem with doing a study like this is you learn how much yet there is still to do. It's amazing. The only thing I can think of off the top of my head right now is that those of you who know about the life of Heber J. Grant know that he maybe wasn't the most talented guy in the world starting out, but if he set his mind to something, whether it's marbles or learning finance or becoming a speaker or a singer or something, he put his mind to it and accomplished it. Be right with you, Jerry. But I did come across the, I think, a fact that Heber J. Grant found a public speaking manual that was published by a BYU faculty member and apparently studied that. Is he? But that's right in with his character. Jerry?
Downstairs in the conference center is a room that has a replica, exact replica. Downstairs in the conference center, there's a room that has a replica of the podium with a television camera and everything. The brother go down and practice,
good.
Watch tapes, and get coaching. Yeah.
Thank you. That's good. I'm going to put that in with your permission. Yes, sir.
Three questions. So, one, try to make it quick. Have you examined or explored the idea of authorship in the sense that I think the assumption is that prophets and general authorities are the ones who put pen to paper and it's their words, but are...
Yeah.
Is that true? Are there ways that talks can be authorized but not necessarily penned by the speakers themselves? Second, have you looked at all between the difference between what is said at the pulpit and what is actually printed in the conference reports?
Yeah.
What gets added, if anything added, what's deleted?
Yeah.
And the third question is that is part of the, or there's a desire to be authentic, right, and sincere. Mm-hmm. But it seems as though what we've seen is the brilliance in the oratory is the amazing effect to which the fabrication is hidden, right? In the sense that general conferences general conference is highly orchestrated, right? Mm-hmm. Highly organized, but yet it seems as though what's so well done is that is so well hidden.
No, there's a lot of questions. In response to part of it, I did find that an apostle named John Taylor, I think it was one of John Taylor's sons, made some disparaging remarks about the Tabernacle Choir in General Conference. He even basically accused some of the men of going over to a house of ill repute between sessions of conference. And why would you say that at General Conference? But anyway, a member of the First Presidency got up and chastised him and told how inappropriate it was, and the Tabernacle Choir did not vote to sustain Elder Taylor. And the First Presidency member signed a deal with it, got the choir together afterwards, and I guess kind of smoothed things over. But apparently this apostle had some emotional instability in his life, and some 10 or 12 years later he was, I think, excommunicated because he was still advocating polygamy or something. But that talk, I don't know why I got off the presence and started reading about apostles, but that talk was not in the conference report. However, it was in collected discourses, and I thought that was interesting. Jerry?
Yeah, Richard, what do you feel your unique primary contribution is for literature in the study of your thoughts?
Very little. Apparently, in the eyes of those who are looking at my book, you know, possible publication. although I have done lots of presentations and a journal article, and it will be published someday, I know. But anyway, let me come back to that, Jerry. The only direct evidence I have or witness about the concept of speech writing, in answer to one of your questions, was my interview with Claire Middlemiss. She said that President McKay did not have a speech writer. And I wouldn't be surprised, though, if some presidents in the rush asked somebody to rough something out, you know, based upon a theme that they asked them to address. I don't know, though. That would be another interesting study to find out about, to do some research on. So I just don't know. What was your third area?
It's okay. You can ask.
Okay. Okay, let me get back to Jerry. I'm sorry. Real quick. You know, I hesitate to say this because there's no way you can claim humility and actually be perceived as being of a humble nature, but I swear to you that I'm not seeking self-aggrandizement at all. It's just interesting to me, and even though I'm not a member of FAIR, for example, I do get their newsletter electronically and read it and agree with what they're doing. And even though a lot of the stuff is very dense, you know, if an academic can't read it, who can, right? So I do read it. But I don't know. I just think this is an area that I'm doing that hasn't been addressed before in a forum like this, in this much depth. One of the reviewers from an academic press, he used kind of a trite term, I guess I'd say, in his review, in that he said, "this massive tome," referring to my manuscript, you know, and I hope they don't make me cut it down. Anyway, a lot of work has gone into that, but I don't know. I just think for both Latter-day Saint and interested non-Latter-day Saints, including perhaps people in news media, who might be covering John Huntsman in the future, running for president, or some other LDS person doing something, why not have a place where you can go other than having to sift through the actual conference reports and at least get a little bit of a summary of what the LDS presidents have said from the horse's mouth, if you will. If that can make some small contribution to the literature, I'll be very happy. Yes, sir.
My name is Kent Olson. Short question. I remember years ago reading conference proceedings while a student here at the University of Utah. And the congregational response was emotional and enthusiastic. Brigham Young would say something that roused people's fur, and they'd say,
yeah,
"Go up, Brigham!"
Yeah.
Things of this sort.
No, wait a minute. You mean, maybe I misheard you. You didn't say you attended those, right?
No. I read about them.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm ancient, but not quite that ancient.
Just
so
teasing.
My question to you is, When did these congregational responses, emotional responses, pretty much end in General Conference?
I didn't see them happen after John Taylor.
Okay.
I'm not saying there weren't an occasional one or two there, but that's the last I remember them being done frequently.
Okay, that's a short question. Now, do you happen to have some statistics, you know, with topics and over time and something of that sort that would give a pictorial depiction of how the conference things have changed?
I personally do not. I have a couple of references in the book, like the Kingdom Transformed book that goes through 79 by Shepherd and Shepherd, University of Utah Press, 84, who did that. They actually counted the salient themes of all the general authorities up through 79. And I didn't want to make this a numbers book, but maybe I could add something. And then the one by Welch and, can't remember the co-author, on Brigham Young, they counted how many times he addressed different topics during his presidency in General Conference. And I'm sure there's some other sources out there, but personally I haven't included that.
Do you have any handouts today?
No, I've got business cards. I actually thought there'd be fewer than this here, and I was wanting to travel light. But I have business cards here. If you'd like a copy of the paper, my email address is on there. Just send me an email, and I'd be glad to send it to you. Okay. Great. Yes, sir.
My name is David. Thank you for your talk. I'm wondering how much awareness or interest the presidents had in rhetoric as a discipline. For example, would they have spoken to the need for BYU to have a department of rhetoric? Or were they themselves aware of the history of rhetoric? Was it something they got into or not?
Good question. I'm only aware of Wilford Woodruff, who was one of the better educated presidents, because he was educated clear through the age of 18 back in the 1800s, which is kind of unusual. And I discovered that one of the topics he did study in his curriculum was rhetoric. I was disappointed some years ago when BYU did away with their debate program. I'm a BYU grad as a master's student, flunked out after three semesters as an undergrad with no major way back in the 60s, early 70s. Had to come back so I could do it, of course, master's. And they don't have public speaking required, as I understand it, as a general education component like we do at Wichita State and several thousand colleges do. It's an elective. So I'm almost, and by the way, interestingly to me, I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but I was at a conference in San Francisco some years ago, and I think I gave a paper on David O. McKay or something, and a gentleman came up afterwards, and he was a professor of communication at Southern Mississippi University, introduced himself, and he said he was LDS, and he said, you might be interested to know that we did a study where we learned, I don't know how they did this, maybe it was easier back then, we identified the religious background of all the students who took public speaking at Southern Miss and compared grades, I don't know how they did this, between those who were LDS and those who were not in public speaking. And the LDS students, on average, had a higher GPA in public speaking. Now, those of you who are affiliated with the LDS Church or have been at one time or another, you realize that there are opportunities for oral expression in the church, you know, from primary on up. And that might give some LDS people an advantage in that realm, which could lead to some people thinking, well, maybe we don't need any formal training or need to study.
One more. We had an opportunity to watch our prophets speak on television from, I think, George Albert Smith on. Is that correct?
Pretty close. Was it about 49, I think, something like that, 48, 49?
And
that
I was just wondering who you felt had the best basic oratory skills and why.
Someone I have seen watch, okay. You can actually get the audio recordings clear back to Wilford Woodruff. He was the first one, then there's a break there. But as far as seeing them on TV, you know, I don't think I can be objective in that because I'm partial to David O. McKay, the president when I became a member, and also back in the day talking about listening to Brigham Young. But when I went on my mission to California, we came up to the mission home or missionary home or something it was called. I think it was right across from where the church office building is right now. And spent a week. And as part of that experience, we were taken to hear, I think it was music and the spoken word, Sunday morning, and David O. McKay was assisted into the tabernacle by his counselors. He was very frail at that time. And I just kind of emotionally, spiritually bonded, you might say, with him at that time. And I've seen some tapes, and in his younger years, even though he was, 76, 77 when he became president, something like that, he was very emotion-evoking, and I'm partial to him for that reason, I think. So I don't think I'd be objective with the others. None of them have been terrible. President Monson, of course, I think before teleprompters was admired because I think he memorized his talks, you know, and it seemed so easy and everything, and didn't look like he was looking at a manuscript or anything. And so he's always been impressive to me as well. President Hinckley, he had a tremendous amount of credibility, not only with Latter-day Saints, but, you know, Larry King, because of his wife, you know, stuff like that. But anyway, I'm going to have to go with David O. McKay, personally. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Yes, this session is now adjourned. Thank you.